T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
All right, we are back. It is about 8 minutes past 8 on a Sunday night, 37 degrees now, clouds out there, and we are in for some snow, so be aware of that. I'm Susie Jones in tonight for Geraldine Steele, who is a bit under the weather, if you're just joining us. Jonathan Lowe at the helm tonight, Jimmy Erickson putting it all together. We've got a big show lined up for you. Really looking forward to Center Stage. I never know what I'm going to ask those artists, but I figure it out along the way, just like I'll do every segment here as we move through the evening. If at any time you want to jump in and share your thoughts on anything we're talking about, you know that line is always open for you. It's 651-989-9226. If you're out of the metro, it's 1-866-989-9226. Thanks again for being part of our night tonight. Well, last week in Duluth, a few of the classics were selected to be removed from the curriculum at their schools, like Huckleberry Finn and To Kill a Mockingbird. And we've invited to the program James LaRue, who is director of American Library Association's Office for Intellectual Freedom, to talk about this removal and what it might mean for classics. Thanks so much for coming on, James.
Well, it's my pleasure to be here, Susie. Thanks for having me.
So Huckleberry Finn and To Kill a Mockingbird, huh?
Yeah. Well, it turns out that we've been tracking challenges to books since about 1990, and Huckleberry Finn is number one on the list. It has been challenged since the very beginning. The interesting thing to me is that the reason that it gets challenged changes over time. When it first came out, librarians said, you know, this is not a good book because it's too colloquial. This is language that reflects, you know, the common parlance, the way people actually talk. And it took a while before it was seen as a classic, and it kind of brought into the canon. And then as time went on, people would say, you know, the use of the N-word is offensive to people. And so, you know, I think one of the ways that we can tell what's really a classic is it's something that irritates people generation after generation.
Now, to come to the aid of some people who don't want those books around is because they are objecting to the N-word. Yeah. Is there any validity to their concerns?
Oh, absolutely. You know, and I look at it like this. So it is undoubtedly the case that both of these books are really classics. You know, the reason that they endure is that they talk about stuff that matters. And if you look at Huckleberry Finn, published in 1885, Jim was the most decent character in the book, and he was enslaved. And To Kill a Mockingbird, you know, kind of challenged at a time when lynching was not all that uncommon in the South. It kind of tackled these things and it kind of talked about the unfairness of it. So they were good, important books at the time that were well written and they endure. But it's also worth pointing out that they're not the only books that were written about these topics, and books about racial concerns don't have to be written by white people. And so my own take about this one is that, you know, the books are not being removed from the libraries. People can still read them at the school. But there are many, many other books that have been written since then or by people of color that maybe deserve a chance in the classroom as well.
Are there concerns among librarians that there has been some restriction of certain books?
You know, and I guess what it comes down to is that, so restriction means what? If we're just freshening up the curriculum to say, you know, let's add something new and let's talk about some of these issues, then that's okay. But if they're saying that, you know, we can no longer discuss these books or we can no longer read those books, that's a different matter. And as I read it, and I've been, you know, kind of studying some of the stories about this, Duluth seems to me to be trying to take a very thoughtful look at this. They're not removing the book from the library. They're just saying there are other books that they want to talk about in the class.
Our guest is James LaRue. He is director of American Library Association's Office for Intellectual Freedom. Are there other titles that are also under fire? We're talking about these two books in Duluth, but what other books have come up that you've had to deal with?
Yeah, it's interesting. I came to work for the American Library Association in 2016, and just as soon as I started, we got the reports of all the books that had been challenged in 2015. And of the top 10 most frequently challenged books, 9 out of 10 of them were by or about diverse populations. You know, and so I think about that. So you say, well, okay, what's going on in America? And you can say that as of 2014, under the age of five, America is now majority non-white. Mm. You know, there's a significant change in the demographics of our nation. And so I think that among the previously privileged population of the United States, they look at this and they say, no, gee, are we still relevant? You know, what about our books and what about our history? And I think that this kind of discussion about how do we talk about changing demographics of America or the changing perspectives of the races of America, not just from a white perspective, that's all fair game.
Yeah. And what is your role as the Director of Intellectual Freedom?
So we kind of do three things. The first thing is that when libraries are challenged, and trust me that libraries are often challenged, we figure that somewhere between 2,500 to 10,000 libraries have to deal with challenges every year to have books either restricted or removed.
Wow.
And when they're in trouble, they call us. And so we say, okay, well, let's start at the very beginning. So do you have a selection policy? Why do you buy the things that you buy? And do you have a request for reconsideration policy? Because what we're seeing around the country, and probably our most powerful example recently has been 13 Reasons Why, which is the Netflix series about suicide.
Mm-hmm.
And what we find is that often high school principals or high school superintendents who are afraid of controversy just walk into the library, take the book off the shelf, and walk out with it.
Mm.
You know, they just don't want anybody to, they don't want any controversy to happen. And there's two ways to look at that. On the one hand, you can say, well, no one, of course, wants to be responsible for sparking suicide in a school. On the other hand, there are people who are probably thinking about it, and maybe the best way to deal with that issue is to talk about it, you know, to be honest about it. And I think that this is the enduring issue in America about literature. How do we engage with important topics? Do we talk about them, or do we try to sweep them under the carpet? And, of course, my philosophy about the American Library Association is that we think we're supposed to talk about it. We think it's better to read the book and discuss it than it is to pretend that it never happened.
Yeah, because I could imagine it would be a slippery slope if all of a sudden we start removing books and restricting access to information and topics. Then what's next?
Well, that's right. You know, and it's funny. I kind of have two philosophies about this. One of them is that I was a public library director in Colorado for many years, and in that time I got 250 challenges to books.
Mm.
And I noticed that probably 90% of them fell into one of two categories. They were parents of children between the ages of 4 and 6, or parents of children between the ages of 14 and 16.
Mm.
And so what was really going on there was that, you know, parents didn't want their kids to grow up.
Yeah.
They didn't want them to find out about how difficult and sometimes violent the world could be. And on the one hand, I totally get that as a father myself. You want to protect the innocence of your children as long as you can.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other hand, as we look at all the problems of the world, the biggest problem in America is not that our children are reading too much. And I think that, in fact, the best way to prepare them for what goes on in the world is to have them read a lot, and then let's talk about it.
It's interesting because I'm a mom myself and grew up, raised my kids to be readers and seekers of information, I should say.
Good.
And I have friends that didn't want their young children to know much. They wanted, oh, we didn't talk about that. We're not going to bring that up. And to some degree, I think it is good. But my kids now will say, you know, Mom, we probably didn't need to listen to the news 24/7. And
right,
you know, being a news person, I think they got a little inundated. But
well, yeah, the same thing with my kids. You know, when you have two parents who are librarians, God help you if you express any interest in any subject, because you're going to be inundated with books and videos and museum visits. And yeah.
My dad was a voracious reader, and always, always, always reading. And anytime you asked him like a question on how to spell a word, you'd have three books to read on the subject of linguistics or some such thing. So I'm a believer of reading myself. But it's interesting. I just keep looking at this number I've written down. 2,500 to 10,000 challenges. Is it really fear at its core, do you think, James?
Yeah, I really do. You know, and let me go back and kind of be clear about this. So probably somewhere around one a day calls the American Library Association to say, help me. Mm-hmm. Someone is challenging this book. How do I defend it? And that doesn't sound like so many, right? We check out millions of books out of America's public libraries every year. Mm-hmm. But back in 2011, there were three different studies. One was done by the ACLU in Texas that said, sent FOIA requests out to every school and public library in the state. And they found that only 3% of the challenges that happened were reported.
Oh.
And much the same thing happened in Missouri and in Oregon. And so it's somewhere between 3 and 12%. And so if you think about this, of course, censorship is most successful where nobody talks about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so kudos to you for saying, you know, the radio says, well, what does it mean when a curriculum changes? Is it censorship? And I really think that's the very best defense we have. Because I'm of the opinion that people want meaning in their lives. Mm-hmm. They want to understand what's going on. And I believe that literature is by far the safest, most powerful way to do this. If a teacher gives some context to say, this is what was going on in the world back in 1885. Mm-hmm. This is what 1960s in the South was like.
Mm-hmm.
That's a pretty powerful lesson, and it teaches people that cultures change, and we hope that they change for the better.
Now, when there are challenges, is it ever successful when they do take a book out of the library because someone has objected to it?
Yeah, and this is another interesting thing. Again, as we try to track all these statistics, and of the things that are reported to us, I used to say that about 10% of them were successful, meaning that someone not just said, I don't like this book, but they said, restrict access to this book, you know, require parental permission, remove it from the classroom, remove it from the library, remove it from the public library. But now I've noticed that if I take a look at like the top 10 from last year, 50% of them were removed from the places where they were challenged.
Wow. Is that?
And I think that,
yeah.
And I think that, again, you know, the unreported ones, censorship is most successful when nobody talks about it.
And that might be, and you don't know where that's happening because it's not reported. And so if
exactly.
There are little pockets in the country where there is that restriction, that's got to be a concern.
Well, and I guess the thing that concerns me about this is that, and I understand this on the parental side. They say, I don't want my child to know about this. I don't want them to think about it. But the truth of it is that not talking about it doesn't make the problem go away,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Whether it's racism or it's teen pregnancy or it's LGBT youth. Just not talking about it doesn't solve anything. And if you're a child and you're trying to figure out, you know, let's say you're a black child and you want to know the history of race relations in the United States, better to read about it and think about it and talk about it in class than be surprised by it outside of the class.
Right, when maybe you're the victim of something that is awful to hear, at least you can understand the context of it.
And I did, and I want to be appreciate the, I think, the intent of the Duluth School District. What they're trying to say is that there are some students that are deeply offended and made uncomfortable by hearing things that in 1885 were common language, but today are considered very offensive. And is that a concern? Well, it certainly is. So it's not wrong to be concerned about that, and it's difficult to find a balance. So the balance is you may take a look at new curricular choices, but you still provide access to that book and you still talk about maybe its significance in literature.
Because I kind of feel like, James, we are kind of in a ultra or hypersensitive time in our societal development. I mean, that
we sure are.
You know what I'm saying? Like somebody's,
oh, yeah.
I mean, and I'm not taking a stand on it. I'm just observing what's happening, and that being, you know, if a sportscaster says something ugly, if a coach of a team says something ugly, if, you know, we just had something happen with this hockey team. I think it was the Washington Nationals where they spoke. What is it?
It was the Chicago Blackhawks and the Washington Capitals.
Thank you. Where one of the players was yelled at in an offensive way. So, and you know what I mean? So there's that piece, but I guess that is somewhat separate than books, or maybe it's on the continuum.
Well, and as I think about this one, you know, on the one hand, it's the case that I believe in free speech. But the problem with free speech is that you don't, it's not just that we defend all the wonder, all the innocuous speech. In fact, I have a friend who is a Denver Bronco, Reggie Rivers.
Mm.
And one of the comments he used to make is that I could stand downtown Denver on a corner and profess my tender affection for butterflies all day long. and nobody cares, right, because it's innocuous. Mm-hmm. You only need to protect free speech when someone is saying something offensive, because what's offensive also changes through time. You know, when Martin Luther King Jr. was starting to speak about civil rights, this is considered deeply offensive to a certain percentage of American population.
Mm-hmm.
And so we definitely fall on the side of, yeah, go ahead and say the things that you are thinking. It's okay to believe various things, but that doesn't exempt you from criticism.
Right. If you are going, exactly.
Someone else is going to talk about it.
Right. If you are going to espouse your views and they are unpopular or offensive, then you have to be willing to take the consequences.
Be prepared. That's right.
Right, right. Well, it's been wonderful to talk to you, James. I really appreciate
it
and your insight, and I love your job. You're the intellectual freedom.
That's right. We fight censorship.
That's what you do, right? No banning of books, which we've seen through the years in different countries as well, and how awful that can be to see a fire with books being thrown into it.
Yeah,
would break my dad's heart.
Mine too.
Yeah, I bet. All right, my friend, thank you for talking to us.
Thank you.
All right, James LaRue is with us again. He is the director of the American Library Association's Office for Intellectual Freedom. The time right now on WCCO is 8:24.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
Gaga. It is 8:27. Jonathan Lowe, Susie Jones in tonight on a Sunday night. Geraldine Steele is not feeling very well. I just watched a documentary on Lady Gaga, and it was very, very interesting. It's about her life and her family and how hard she works to do all of that which she does to be Lady Gaga. And man, oh, live. I was struck in this documentary as well by how many people are on her all the time. Do you know what I'm saying, Jonathan? So, like, somebody's putting her makeup on, somebody's giving her a massage, somebody's... I mean, it's just like, that would drive me bananas.
Well, it's part of it goes with, I guess, for some people, you'd call the diva lifestyle. It's the lifestyle of these famous people, whether they be some sort of entertainer or maybe a politician or a royalty, mm-hmm. British royalty, for example. And they have all of these handlers. You know, they have these people that make them into a certain image or try to get them ready to go for a performance or something of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know what it would be like to be in that situation. It'd be interesting to find out, you know, if we could get sometime in the future a handler of a big-time star or a star in the past to come on and talk about what is it like, how many people did these people have around them?
Because
mm-hmm. that's part of it. It's an entourage.
Yeah.
It's just so many people that either work for you or some maybe hangers-on. But it's, again, I have no idea what that would be like.
Yeah.
No idea.
I think I would be irritated, but that's just me. So are we going to take a little break here?
I will say this. I wouldn't mind being pampered. You want to feed me grapes? That's okay. I will lie on a chaise lounge and you can feed me grapes. That is just fine.
Or you could put lotion on my back.
Or chocolate chip cookies, either one.
There you go.
Yes.
Or, you know, English muffins, whatever it is.
Yes, I need I can't even think of the name of the butler for Batman.
Oh.
Alfred. I need an Alfred.
You need an Alfred.
I need an Alfred.
All right. Well, we'll work on that. All right. It is 8:29. We have to take a little tiny break, and I'll do a little weather and then our next guest after this. 8:34 on a Sunday night. Happy to have you with us. I hope you're having a good night, whatever you're doing. Maybe you're watching the Olympics. How's Lindsey Vonn doing anyway? She was just on the screen. I don't know what she's doing.
She was just doing a training run. They're doing training runs for the downhill, and I believe that takes place on Tuesday night.
Yeah, Tuesday.
Yeah, Tuesday night here, Wednesday morning there.
Got it.
So they're doing training runs, her and Michaela Schifrin. I don't know if Schifrin's going to do the downhill. She was thinking about it, but yeah, Vonn just did her second training run, and She did okay in the Super G, Super Giant Slalom.
She finished sixth,
but had a big stumble near the end
to
fall out of medal contention.
And the All-Star Game's on right now, and I see Karl Anthony Towns.
Yes, Karl Anthony Towns, Jimmy Butler are both on Team Stephen Curry.
Yep.
They are leading just before halftime. And Steve was wondering earlier in the day what the over-under for the points was going to be. I'll have to see if I can find that, because that was an interesting question. With an All-Star game, you could have somewhere in the neighborhood of 350 points.
Holy smokes. Just everybody's throwing it up there.
Yeah.
All right, well, we'll keep our eye on that for you as we move through the evening here, or if anything spectacular happens on the Olympics or the All-Star game. But right now, we're going to switch gears a little bit and talk to my good friend, Colleen Moriarty. She is executive director, give me a minute, I know exactly what it is, of Hunger Solutions. And there was a story recently about the Trump administration proposing to overhaul the nation's food stamp program. So instead of giving out food stamps, the idea would be to provide a food box to families. Is this a good idea? Is this a bad idea? Colleen, how are you?
I'm great. How are you? Good to hear your voice.
Well, thank you. You know, Geraldine got sick and I got the call up off the bench, which happens to me from time to time. And I do enjoy hosting.
Fun surprise. I love it.
Yeah, I never really, you know, I just listen. I always say to people, the art of interviewing is listening.
Right.
If you don't listen to the answer that someone just said and you pick up on a piece of the answer, you're not a good interviewer. And I'm a pretty good interviewer, I think. And I'm not bragging.
I think so, too.
So I talked a little bit about this with another hunger advocate in the cities about this idea of revamping food stamps. I would imagine you are a bit concerned about it.
I am concerned about it. And I think that my concern is firmly grounded in reality, which I cannot say the same for this proposal. I really believe that the SNAP program is the most effective tool we have in this country for reducing hunger. And one of the byproducts of the SNAP program is that the money is spent in local communities. When the person receives a SNAP allocation, a benefit allocation, they use that in Kakato, they use that in International Falls, they use it in urban areas, but all over the state and all over this country, those dollars are kept locally to stimulate the economy, which is a wonderful benefit of the SNAP program and something that was recognized in 2008 as a way to stimulate the economy. What this proposal, in essence, does is it really cuts the program, although the proposal doesn't exactly say that, but it would eliminate about 260,000 retail stores from participating in the program. It would really tax the system to be able to provide a box of commodities, because commodities are not set up that way. And so there's no discussion about the reality of that happening. And then it would take about half of about $60 billion and turn it back to the government.
Oh, I didn't realize that was part of the plan.
Right. And with no guarantee that would be used for nutrition.
Right, right. But for people that are just listening now, when you called it the SNAP, what does that stand for?
It's Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. It used to be called the Food Stamp Program. And I think that part of the logic behind changing the name was it was never intended to be something that would, the grant would never be something that would be able to meet all of your needs for the entire month. It's a supplemental program, and it's only the only people who are eligible for the program are people who are income eligible. In this state, that is 165% of poverty, or about $30,000 for a family of four.
How many people in Minnesota use the food stamp program, use SNAP?
Over 600,000.
600,000.
Yes.
And roughly, like, the idea is you get $100, or is it based on your family size?
It's based on your family size. And one of the things this proposal does is it caps the size of your family. So if your family's too large, as dictated by this proposal, then that you wouldn't get any additional food for that person. The other thing it does that really is just very worrisome to me is there are many, many seniors who are at risk for hunger in this country, and many of them in this state. And we've been working so hard to try and improve the numbers of seniors who take advantage of the program, because it can really help. It can help them stay in their home. It can help their medicine work better. Mm-hmm. And we've made some real progress on seniors participating in the program, only to find out that in this proposal, it eliminates the lowest benefit, which is the benefit that many seniors use. Mm. So it really cuts seniors off of a program that really is very helpful to them. It's helpful to children too. It's helpful to people who are disabled. It's helpful to people who've fallen on hard times. Mm. But I'm really concerned about what else there would be out there for many of these seniors who have come to really rely on the program to be able to go to the farmer's market. In this state, we have a program where they can double their money at the farmer's market buying Minnesota grown or others fresh fruits and vegetables. Mm-hmm. And I think that would just be a shame to limit the participation by the people who are the most vulnerable.
And these food boxes, what is that all? Did they specify what would be in them?
I've listened to some discussion about it. They talk about it, commodities, shelf staple milk or powdered milk, noodles, spaghetti sauce. And that, there's no kind of recognition for the fact that some people have a lot of health considerations. When people have the SNAP dollars, they can get what they need. Mm-hmm. They can get fresh fruits and vegetables. Mm-hmm. And that's very important. And we've come a long way in really promoting the nutritional value of not just the SNAP program, but food shelves and others. Mm-hmm. The other thing is that, the administration kind of drew a parallel between this box of commodities that would be somehow delivered to people and the Blue Apron, which is a high-end meal delivery service, which is just really one meal. And the cost of that meal, the Blue Apron meal, is around $10 to $12. And the average allocation for SNAP for a meal is $1.37. So I don't think there's any. And there's a lot of packaging in the, I don't know if you've ever gotten Blue Apron or any of those.
No, I haven't. No.
Well, I haven't either, but some friends of mine who have said, that there's a lot of packaging to keep everything fresh because, of course, it's, fresh food. And there's no precedent for the government delivering boxes of food to people. It seems like it would be a nightmare. So
where are we at with it? I mean, is it just in the proposal stage? Is it likely to go through, or do you think there'll be big pushback?
Here's my fear. I think this is the president's budget proposal, right? And mm-hmm. It's not in law. It's not anything that's being voted on. And, they kind of put things out in the budget that they don't really expect maybe are going to get picked up on. Mm-hmm. But what it does do is kind of lull people, I think, into a complacency to think, well, maybe we should cut that program. I don't think the way to fund the kinds of things that the president or the administration are interested in, whether they're tax cuts or increases for the military or big public works projects, are by cutting the poorest people in the country. I just believe there are other areas that they could find some revenue in besides services to the poorest people in our country.
Colleen Moriarty is our guest. She is Executive Director of Hunger Solutions, and we're talking about a proposal to basically scrap the food stamp program. Instead of food stamps, people getting food boxes. But as you say, it's just in the proposal phase. I'm just reading a little bit about Hunger Solutions Minnesota, and where are we in Minnesota with hunger? I know it's a constant battle, a constant challenge. Is it getting worse? Is it getting better? How would you characterize it?
I would say we're about 1 in 10 people in the state of Minnesota are food insecure. And what that means is they don't know where their next meal is coming from. We've seen the numbers really rose in 2008, 9, and 10. Mm-hmm. And we've just stayed there. Mm-hmm. We've kind of leveled off at the highest level we've ever had. And I think there's lots of reasons for that. I think that there are more people who didn't get the same level of employment that they got maybe before the Depression, recession, or, you know, people just, the costs just keep escalating and their income hasn't kept pace with it. But what we've seen is that, you know, we've just kind of stayed at that level, at that high 2008. And just to kind of put that in perspective for people, there are about 3 million visits to food shelves in our state every year. So that's like one every 7 minutes. Someone in this state is visiting a food shelf because they basically don't know where their next meal is coming from.
Yeah. And, you know, for people that have looked into this, as I have, working with WCCO Radio and the work that we do in kicking hunger, fighting hunger, they're your neighbor. I mean, if you went to a food shelf, you might very much look like the person in line to get their groceries.
Absolutely. And that's one of the things about the SNAP program, too, that it's been so great because it comes on an EBT card. You can only use it for food, mm-hmm. and you can only use it for fresh food. You can't buy any prepared food. Mm-hmm. You can't buy any, you know, toilet paper or paper towels or diapers or anything like that. Mm-hmm. And it's a EBT card. It looks like a bank card. Mm-hmm. So there isn't this humiliation of, you know, being signaled out as being the poor person buying groceries. You could be pretty seamless in going to Cub or anywhere else and buying food, which is really wonderful for people at a time when they need their need and they can have dignity in the process. Absolutely. I think that's very important.
It's very important. Yeah, I know. Because, you know, you don't know what it is that's going to put you in a position where you might need help.
Right. It could be a medical emergency. It could be, I was participating in a forum one night, and the person next to me had just these horrific car accidents and ended up using SNAP, and she was telling her story. And after she was finished, she said, "You look so familiar." And we discovered that we grew up a block from each other and went to high school together. And, you know, it's just, it can happen to anybody. Mm-hmm. So we, you know, renewed our friendship, but you know, it could happen to anybody. You never know.
Yeah. I was talking to Paul Douglas earlier on this program, and he talked about, you know, what we do for the least of us. You know, we know that we tend to bury our head in the sand or just get so busy we don't think about other people and where they might be in life. And so it's important to do that because you just never know when you may be the one ending up needing some help.
And I think that's one of the things about this proposal that just struck me. It just seems so mean. It's so mean. And it's so attacking people who have the least ability to defend themselves. That's just wrong.
Yeah. Well, hopefully it won't get anywhere. I mean, hopefully we'll keep it as the status quo. But I also wanted to make sure I jumped in and talked to you about the big campaign in March. I know it's a big month. A lot of work into it. I know we're not that far from March, so we can maybe jump in here and talk about what you do during the month of March.
Well, it isn't as much what we do, but Minnesota Food Share and food shelves all over the state are raising money and getting donations for food. And this is the time of year, you know, usually during the holidays, people think about the food shelves, but you know, the shelves get pretty bare this time of year. And as the winter, you know, marches on, it's even more important. I noticed I was up north this last weekend and I saw some signs on the local food shelf that said, you know, they could only be open one day a week now. So I really encourage people to work with your local congregation, to work with drop-off spots and support Minnesota Food Share and support the March program because it makes a tremendous difference.
And you mentioned, too, Colleen, outstate, and I do think sometimes we think it's an inner-city problem, but it is just absolutely knows no socioeconomic, urban, suburban, or rural bounds, does it?
Absolutely. And that there are just, as you know, it's kind of equally spread around, unfortunately, the numbers of people on the SNAP program throughout the state and the numbers of people who, and, you know, it's greatly even hit the agriculture community, you know, as the there are tough times, and a lot of young farmers and other people, you know, they have to use the SNAP program during the winter. So it's not as if the, you know, we are an agriculture state and we're a state of very generous people, but we also need to just help each other and just, you know, just be kind. And it could happen to anybody.
Yeah. And it's been pretty successful, the Minnesota Food Share March campaign, has it not?
Very successful.
It started in 1982. Congregations got together and started restocking food shelves in the 7-county metro. And what did I read here? In 2017, more than $8 million and 4.7 million pounds of food were raised.
Right.
That's phenomenal.
And people, you know, people are used to the campaign and know about it, so I think that makes a difference. But if you have a newer congregation that isn't participating, you could be the light to, you know, really go to your congregation and ask them to participate, or ask your workplace to participate. Or, you know, all of those movements will make a difference to hungry people in this state.
And how do we find out about the March campaign? Is there information?
MinnesotaFoodShare.org.
MinnesotaFoodShare.org. Okay, very good.
Right.
Well, it was good to talk to you, Colleen.
Good to talk to you.
Anything else going on you want to share while I got you on 50,000 watts of the mothership?
I was up north this weekend, and we drove back through that blizzard from Grand Marais.
Oh, Lord.
Oh, my God, but it was so beautiful.
Yeah, so you're not terrified of crashing into a tree. It is
beautiful.
I know.
I hope it's not a vision of what's coming here, because it was pretty much a whiteout.
When did you come back?
About 10 o'clock this morning.
Yeah. I think that area of the state got kind of slammed. I don't know how much, you know, Paul says it's not going to be. He said it's a 3 on a scale of 1 to 5 for, like, difficult driving. So it might be messy the next couple of days, but we can get through it, right?
Absolutely. All right. Take care of yourself.
You too. Talk to you soon. Yep, you too.
Okay.
Colleen Moriarty with us again. She is the Executive Director of Hunger Solutions Minnesota, talking with us about this plan to switch from food stamps to these food boxes, plus what's going on in Minnesota when it comes to hunger, and then, of course, that March campaign coming up in weeks. I can't even believe it's almost March already. Well, it is about 52 minutes past 8 o'clock. I'm Susie Jones, and we've got a big hour. This next hour, Jonathan, is filled with beautiful artists, and some of them are coming in studio, so we will let you know what's coming up right after this on WCCO.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
It is 55 minutes past 8 o'clock, 5 minutes in front of 9 o'clock. I'm Susie Jones. In for Geraldine tonight. Happy to have you with us. Sometimes I wonder what I stand for. Is that what the song is saying?
Yes, this is the song Some Nights by Fun.
Fun.
The group Fun, yes.
So people listening at home, a little behind the scenes, pulling back the curtain, Jonathan Lowe is playing music. He gets a turn, and then I get a turn.
Yes, we're alternating tonight, because usually it's our job to pick something out, try to pick something that's, if we're doing our job correctly, it's going to be relevant to the conversation, as relevant as it can be.
Without being obvious.
Sometimes it can be just dead obvious.
Right.
But
I think we have a theme tonight. I'm feeling a theme of, here's my theme. Here's our theme tonight.
Okay.
It's sort of, it's freedom of speech. We've got the library. We had the campus neutrality bill. Then it's sort of about justice and being nice to people and the food, you know, food programs. And now we're going to move into the world of art.
Yes. I think the way that the first couple of hours were designed by our intrepid producer.
Esteemed
intrepid producer, Jimmy Erickson. Yes. These are polarizing issues right now, and these are issues that are very topical and in the government, and at the top of the government food chain, if you will. No pun intended.
Yes, I think it was intended.
But You have again the freedom of speech, the censorship of speech, and the political correctness issue was touched on a little bit in that interview with Mr. LaRue, and then the food stamp item, which is very topical, very timely, and so it's just the way Jimmy Erickson does. It's what he do. Is like as I would like to say. It's what he do.
It's what he do.
It's what he do.
Have you ever had been close to thinking about going to a food show?
No. I've been very fortunate. And that's one thing that I think some people misunderstand. They look at people that go to food shelves or they go to they're on food stamps or they're on welfare and they downplay them. I hope I never do that. I may have done that in the past. If I have, I've been wrong.
Mm.
Because in life, you don't a lot of times pick your situations. Your situations pick you.
Yes.
And so you have to be fortunate in the situations working out in your favor.
Right.
And I've been very fortunate in my entire upbringing, my entire life, that the situations have worked for me.
That's
so
nice.
So I always want to think that way
mm-hmm.
if I'm in that position.
Very good. Jonathan Lowell. I actually have never either, but I will say this. Years ago when I worked in La Crosse, Wisconsin, Jonathan, we would have to do stories on various things. And there was a story in Wisconsin where they were giving away blocks of cheese to people that didn't have enough money. And we were so poor in La Crosse at that time that we all qualified for the cheese. So we didn't take it, but we thought about it. We could have. 858 on WCCO.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.